The concept of justice is central to the American experience. We celebrate it in our monuments and in our history. But who gets justice and who defines it are seldom considered questions. Today's guest is a practicing attorney and dystopian novelist who combines his talents in a new novel exploring these concepts in a different America. He's Christopher Brown this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Each week we talk big issues with great guests, filmmakers, authors, journalists, and more to make sense of the stories that shape public life in the United States today. To help us this week, we're joined by Christopher Brown, a dystopian novelist whose latest book, Rule of Capture, explores the meaning of justice. Chris, it's great to see you again. Thank you for coming back to Story in the Public
Square. Thanks for having me back. Delighted to be here.
So talk to us about Rule of Capture. Without giving anything away, what's it about?
Well, the elevator pitch is it's Better Call Saul meets 1984. That's a little cheeky. It's a little both darker and lighter than that sounds. It's a dystopian legal thriller, a mashup, if you will, of the dystopian novel and the legal thriller, the all-American lawyer story. It tells the story of a kind of burned-out criminal defense lawyer in an America that's drifting into totalitarianism. He's taking court appointments in a new court that's been set up to deal with people who are sort of resisting the authority of the federal government and the state government where he is, and ends up being assigned to represent a young woman, a filmmaker, who's been witnessed a political assassination and is being charged with kind of terrorism crimes, basically to shut her up. To free her and to free some other clients, he has to try to figure out how to get justice from a system that's basically abandoned the rule of law, meaning the lawyer has to break the rules to try to get some measure of justice.
So this mashup of a legal thriller and a dystopian novel, how did you get there? How do those two different genres work together?
Yeah, it's a funny thing in a way. It started with a billboard ad I saw while standing outside a coffee shop by a highway in Austin, Texas, where I live, while I was working on my last book, Tropic of Kansas, and I had this scene I was working on where two characters had been put in jail. And one was trying to get out, and I wondered, well, in a dystopian society, you know, who would the lawyers be? And I look up at this billboard, and there's this ad for this great, you know, in Texas, where I live, lawyer ads flourish like prickly pear, especially by the side of the road and on the cathode ray. And this one was a very Austin one for a guy whose handle, to make the clients remember him, is the lawyer who rocks. So he's like, you know, so if you want your criminal defense lawyer to also be a guy who's in a band. But I was like, yeah, well, what would the dystopian version of that guy be? And that idea just stuck with me. And as I dug into it, I realized it was much more interesting territory than just the kind of the humor and the character of that. That interesting character leads to interesting ideas about having a viewpoint into really kind of digging into what justice really is in America and how the society is really kind of constructed.
So I want to dive deeper on those issues, but I know that you this was a thought process that occurred to you while you were writing Tropic of Kansas, which was a phenomenal book. But this was, how does that grow from an idea that I think got left on the editing room floor?
Yeah, I mean, I had written a couple of scenes with this guy and removed them because it was just too sort of marginal to the main story. His billboard does show up briefly. There is a phone call, but he never appears on stage in that book. You know, it's a funny thing. I mean, it starts with character. I mean, I'm trying to write a character-driven fiction that's entertaining, but also uses the tools of science fiction to deal with kind of bigger ideas. And this idea just, I was really attracted by it. I mean, maybe it's because I'm a lawyer who also is a writer, and I've been a lawyer who writes science fiction for a long time, two things that would seem like they wouldn't necessarily go together. And I had never been that interested in lawyer stories kind of coming up, and I'm suddenly like, oh, this interesting material here. There's like, this is like this rich kind of body of material that everybody's familiar with, and you, if you kind of grab it and repurpose it for your own ends, my thinking was you can do something really interesting and fresh with it, and I hope others will agree. I've managed to
do that.
So
what year was it when you saw this billboard and you had this germ of an idea that became your book?
It would have been 2013 or 14 when I was writing Tropic of Kansas.
So you're writing Tropic of Kansas, which is a fantastic book. We've had you on and talked about it before. You take this idea, what happens, you're writing another book. I mean, you're immersed in writing a book. What do you do with this other idea? Do you make notes? Do you tuck it away? Do you have dreams about it? Talk about the process.
I had a jet lag dream about it. There's a scene that ends, I was like, I had gone to see a family event in Europe. Of a family member who's an artist, and I woke up in the middle of the night in a hotel, and I'd had this crazy jet lag dream about a scene of a guy playing golf with some fascists of the idea of like what would an American fascism look like, and would it look kind of like hanging out at the country club? And it was a scene with this lawyer, and I still have those notes, and I like got up at 3 a.m. and wrote those notes, and the idea of a window into that little shift into how could, the society we have kind of drift off onto a tangent that would be one we wouldn't really want to enjoy. So you let stuff like that percolate, and then you try to come up with a little bit more story. But it starts with that kind of nugget of character, and you just sort of build it from there. You try to imagine a kind of a case-type trajectory, but you basically write your way into it.
So when you're creating a character, you've talked about the beginning of this process. Past the germ and the idea and the dream, how do you get into the mind of that character? How do you create that character?
Yeah, you have to immerse yourself in that kind of world of that character. I mean, I spent a lot of time. I've not primarily been involved with criminal law or even trial law in my own career as a lawyer. But I've been involved at the margins. And another kind of experience I had while working on Tropic of Kansas that had a big influence on this was I served on a grand jury in the county where I live in Austin, where you're meeting every three days a week for a period of months, hearing every felony indictment that the county attorney or the district attorney wants to bring. And I got that sort of window into how justice, the machinery of justice really works in this country, that helped me think about the role of those kinds of lawyers who were the kind of champions of the underdogs, if you will. And then I spent a lot of time, Wayne, hanging out in the federal courthouse in Austin watching trials and seeing from another angle how things really work. And a lot of the scenes in the book are just drawn straight from that, from kind of things I saw in the courtroom and cases that no one was really paying much attention to, just the everyday machine and work working its way through the lives of humans.
This is a perfect segue, I think, into sort of a conversation about what speculative fiction is, because in our conversations, both on the show a couple years ago and then in our phone call a week ago, we talked about sort of you're writing about the world that you've seen. That dystopian is a kind of realism. Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to use speculative fiction, whether it's dystopian or utopian or whatever angle of attack you want to undertake, to kind of take the material of the observed world and maybe dial up or down certain elements of it to try to understand the world that could be, right? And to kind of put a funhouse mirror up to the world, if you will, but keep it as closely yoked to the real as you can, to the kinds of things that practitioners of so-called social realism do, and to allow some idea content to kind of come into the story to let you play with the possibility of how fiction can serve as a kind of a laboratory to think about other ways in which life could be maybe better, sometimes maybe look at a darker version of the world we live in to try to imagine what could be on the other side of that. And also by introducing a little bit of wonder into it, you hopefully make it a little more interesting than what you see out the world every day. But more than anything, by slightly twisting it, letting people see things, to see truths in the world around them that realism can't show.
Do you find that your fiction draws readers into not only the world of fiction, but the world of fiction examining the real world that might not otherwise come to, for example, who might not read nonfiction, who might not be exploring the issues you do? Fiction provides an additional lore to those.
I think if you can, I think it does a lot of things that, say, nonfiction cannot. If you're writing a fiction that's trying to kind of tackle into the issues, even like the issues that we're dealing with in our politics and society on a daily basis, you remove the reader's mind from the sort of partisan tribalisms of everyday life and the identities that we're so deeply socialized into that kind of can keep us from opening our eyes up to seeing things with a little bit more objectivity. You know, in the world of my books, there are, you know, no Republicans or Democrats. There's no kind of real political figures other than at the margins. Even the pop culture is made up. And yet the idea is that by doing that, you can bring in kind of even more truth, even more reality about, you know, like, well, how really does the world work?
What do you hear from readers? I'm assuming you get a lot of feedback from your books.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, with this book, what I'm hearing from people is they're finding it, generally speaking, a really entertaining read, you know, a kind of a propulsive page-turner, as it were.
I would second that.
Which is delightful to hear, because that's not something that comes naturally to me. I have to kind of write my way into it. And then a lot of people have said that then it kind of leaves them thinking about bigger ideas when they're done. And, you sort of race through it and then, like, start thinking about some of the things that I try to put a lens onto, as it were, to let people think about, you know, how does the law really work? What really is the basis of the justice system? What really gives that judge the power to put me in jail?
Well, and so you mentioned that, you know, you're using dystopian fiction, speculative fiction, to sort of reflect on some truths. What's the truth about justice that sort of is animating Rule of Capture?
I mean, the truth about justice that's animating Rule of Capture, there are a couple. I mean, one is that something that I learned in the grand jury system, that often in the criminal law in this country, the clients are guilty, but the things they're guilty of are, in the grand scheme of things, maybe not really that criminal. And the way in which those rules are applied is often unjust, maybe in a kind of everyday, not really conscious way, maybe in a very conscious way in some instances. And so in this book, I sort of make it, I exaggerate slightly that notion that it's sort of self-evidently, it's like we have a government drifting into totalitarianism, and it's like, if you don't agree with them, that's a crime, basically. So kind of take that idea and push it a little bit. The other thing that this digs into is more of like an environmental theme, and sort of drawing on my own experience as a business lawyer, as a lawyer who's worked, you know, in the hearts of 21st century capitalism to look at, you know, like, how is it exactly that I own the land on which my house sits? And how is it that, you know, a particular group of people has the right, the enforceable right, to occupy the land and to do certain things to the land, to take from the land? And kind of digging into that, into the idea that, well, maybe if you look back far enough, at the root of all property rights is some form of theft. Right? It's kind of a good...
If you go back to the indigenous people who were here first, that's a good case.
Yeah, well, and if you live where I do in Texas, one of the things, I'm originally from the Midwest, and one of the things that has been a real awakening for me moving to Texas was realizing how many of my neighbors you know, were people who self-identify as indigenous, who people who have family histories that, you know, predate the European settlement of the continent. And and when you literally get to know your neighbors on those terms that way and see the world through their eyes as best you can, it really opens up a different way of looking at kind of the world around you and the history of the, you know, the kind of the dirt under your feet.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard four times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a remarkable crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. And if you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me as he does every week in the co-host chair is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who is the author of 17 books and is also an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. You can find Wayne on Twitter too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is a novelist who explores the America he knows through dystopian fiction. His latest book, Rule of Capture, is set in the same world as his acclaimed Tropic of Kansas. He's Christopher Brown, and you can catch him on Twitter at NB_Chris. That's NB_Chris. One of the most popular genres of American fiction is the lawyer story. How much of that did you consult in putting together Rule of Capture?
A ton. As I mentioned, you know, I had not really historically been super conversant in that genre. I had read bits and pieces, so I really dived in, and I dug into a variety of the kind of great, you know, paradigmatic stories from the contemporary legal thrillers of the likes of, you know, Grisham and Michael Connelly and Lisa Scottoline and Scott Turow and those sorts of folks. The sort of 20th century examples, like obviously the stories like To Kill a Mockingbird, mm-hmm. a kind of a model of that story of, you know, the kind of paladin of justice, or those Perry Mason stories that Earl Stanley Gardner wrote, which were the basis of this television show I always thought looked so snoozy when I was a kid. And I went back and I looked at it like, oh, these are really kind of cool. This guy's like the ultimate trickster. And then I even went further back to these like really early American lawyer stories. Like, there was this, and a lot of these stories, they're practicing lawyers who decided to write fiction, and which is a kind of a peculiar thing in and of itself, how much of that there is, mm-hmm. right? But there was one, this guy named Melville Davison Post, who was did debt collections law in West Virginia in the turn of the last century. And he wrote this series of stories that are basically about a lawyer who, what he does is he helps the clients get away with the crime. And that was kind of the like revelation. When he has this one story called Corpus Delicti that's sort of famous, where it's about the lawyer helps the client commit murder and get away with it. And it's like presented as if that's a happy ending in a way. Looking back at all of these other later American lawyer stories through that prism, made me realize that I think a lot of them are, on the surface, they pretend to be about, you know, helping the innocent person get off, proving them innocent of some crime, but really they are about that kind of all-American dream of doing something wrong and getting away with it.
So you've just given us a lot of great examples of lawyers in popular culture. What is the enduring fascination with lawyers in their many types, of many of which you just... And you're one, so you've got to obviously can give us a good answer.
Yeah, I mean,
why are we so fascinated with lawyers? And we are.
Well, they're the
good, bad, and indifferent.
They're the kind of the they represent the regulators of what we can and can't do. There are sort of two dipoles of the archetypal lawyer. One is the sort of the that Atticus Finch, you know, champion of justice, you know,
paragon of virtue,
yeah,
heroic,
yeah, taking care of the people, you know, yeah. being unafraid to speak the truths that everyone else is afraid to confront, or to call out the injustices in the society around them. And there are a lot of great examples like that in real life as well. And then there's the kind of the Better Call Saul type, the kind of the lying, sneaking one. Or it's like there used to be that Martin Short character who'd play the like tobacco industry lawyer who's, you know, just peddling a series of lies. And I think those characters are, you know, they're us. They're all variations of us to some respect. And the way they conduct themselves tells us a lot about, you know, the society we live in and the way we want it to be.
Do we see our own engagements with lawyers through the prism of that literature, through the prism of that fiction?
Yeah, I think we have. The lawyer stories, yeah. we grow up with, and it's such a, you know, a kind of a seminal genre of like our popular culture. I mean, these stories, they're there, they're all over, you know, in contemporary television, they're all over the place, and because they work, they have their own kind of self-contained like narrative formula, where it's all, they even work well like in, you know, live theater. I mean, they're really, it's just all kind of in the courtroom in a way. And they work to let us be programmed to think that the lawyers are going to behave in a certain way, such that when you then turn on the TV and there's a bunch of lawyers parading around litigating constitutional crisis, if you're like me, you're sort of like, well, where is Atticus Finch when we need him?
So what attracted you to law?
The opportunity to be engaged with, you know, the system of justice and with government and politics originally. I mean, I was a wonky kid in college and was interested in both journalism and public affairs, and public law was kind of the route to public affairs. I spent a little bit of time in Washington right out of college, and I saw that, you know, having a law degree was a kind of a key to be able to have access to a lot of the opportunities to do more interesting things.
There's sort of structures to a legal thriller that are different from a lot of other fiction. Like we're never going to see inside the lead lawyer's mindset, because that'll give away whatever the
right.
whatever the denouement's going to be. How does that affect the way you have to write a story like this?
It's really tricky. So as a writer, when I dug into these legal thrillers and other lawyer stories, it's like, oh, these guys, they break all the rules. One of the sort of most basic rules of writing fiction is show, don't tell. That you represent the experience of the character through kind of quotidian detail and showing them doing things. And courtroom dramas, at least, are all the opposite. They're sort of tell, don't show. All the action, the real action of the story, is sort of one step removed from these people in the courtroom presenting the story through live testimony, through oral argument, and so on. So that's a really tricky thing. So figuring out how to work with that and make it work well is intriguing. And there are great examples of people who pull it off. The great German playwright Peter Weiss had this play called The Investigation, where he just took trial transcripts from the Frankfurt Auschwitz trials and just sort of use that and to tell a story in a way that lets you deal with really difficult material with enough remove that you can kind of look at it straight in the face, but yet still have a kind of narrative oomph to it. So, and you know, the role the person plays defines what kind of character they are, whether they're the prosecutor or the defense lawyer or the judge or the witness or the victim. And those things are tricky to work with, but it's a lot of fun. They're like with any kind of fiction writing project, having those constraints can produce really interesting results. It gives you a little problem you gotta solve and then run with it.
So rule of capture, like Tropic of Kansas, seems to have predicted events that are happening now. So Jim and I have a theory that you have a secret power, which you can share or not share, but in all seriousness, how does that happen? How did you, I mean, this was written more than a year ago, and yet it captures or seems to capture what is happening now, obviously in a fictive sense, but.
I would put it this way, that it's not unimaginable. The world that you describe is not, I think about the trials at Guantanamo Bay, or I think about some of the extra constitutional things that we've done since 9/11, and I go,
that's
passes
really,
the Google test.
I mean, a big part of why I wanted to write this book was my frustration at those post 9/11 things, where I thought, you know, here are all these lawyers who are just writing the memos that pave the way for in my opinion, the abandonment of the rule of law, or at least the abandonment of norms that I thought were well established. The great science fiction writer William Gibson has a famous aphorism that the future is already here, it's just not evenly distributed, almost overquoted at this point. But I think that observation he makes there is really true about writing a kind of speculative fiction that does what you're talking about, Wayne, where you know, the dystopia is already here, it's just not evenly distributed. If you look for, you know, if you kind of focus in on certain things, like, you know, like the Guantanamo tribunals. I mean, I drew heavily. I mean, some of the procedural elements in this book are basically airlifted straight in from Guantanamo, as it were. There was I read these amazing books by the sketch room, the mm-hmm. courtroom sketch artists who went there and researched the law of this book simply by going to the law library and saying, well, if you wanted to have martial law, how would you do it? And lo and behold, you kind of go to the back of the stacks, the law library, here's this section of books like, you know, The Practical Administration of Martial Law. Because, you know, if you're looking for anything kind of scary, usually if you look far enough into the right corners of American history, you can find some example of it. And before World War II, the use of martial law was very common by governors, especially dealing with labor disputes and just like, you know, kind of economic issues. Or other sorts of iterations of like emergency powers that the, you know, federal and state executives can invoke. The suspension of habeas corpus is a power that's right there in the Constitution. And it's
happened across history.
And it's just not hard to imagine emergency powers being abused and, you know, without getting into things going on today. I mean, there are certainly examples where you can play with a counterfactual and imagine things going just a little bit of a shift one way or the other that would be that moment.
We've got about 15 seconds left. I think we could talk to you all day, but what's next for you?
Next is a follow-up to this story, a book I'm calling Failed State, which is, notwithstanding the title, a kind of utopian work about this same lawyer defending people in front of a post-revolutionary justice tribunal, an effort to kind of explore like truth and reconciliation.
Well, we will look forward to that. Chris
and we'll
Brown,
have you back for sure.
Absolutely. Chris Brown, the book is Rule of Capture. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter or visit pellcenter.org where you can always catch up on previous episodes. He's Wayne, I'm Jim. We hope you'll join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.